He is probably one of the most inventive individuals I've ever met. He's brilliant. But in addition to being brilliant, he's a great actor's director. And that was, I was so taken with that. Because he is so, John is so action-oriented that you think of him, oh, he's a great action director. Oh, this is like working with John Ford, who got great performances as well as wonderful, wonderful movies, John Ford. And I think of John McTiernan in many ways like John Ford.
He shoots the film in his head first, so he knows what he wants. He's already seen it in his mind, and he's very prepared. And he uses the camera, I think, more than any guy I've ever worked with to tell the story as well, which is like having another character in the film. You know, it gives you information without dialogue being spoken, and he creates suspense with it, and to a very large degree, is responsible for building that suspense and taking you on that roller coaster of ups and downs through the films.
At the time of this interview, John McTiernan had directed only 7 feature films. Yet those films have established him as one of the industry's foremost directors of action-adventure movies. His work has gained him a worldwide following, significant critical acclaim, and has set the standard for an entire genre of films. His expertise at presenting stunning visual cinema images, combined with outstanding performances from his actors, has set him apart from the crowd. McTiernan has a reputation for being his own man, for knowing what he wants and pursuing it with a vengeance until he masters the exact effect he set out to achieve. He is a demanding director who demands the very best of himself.
I was going to Juilliard in New York. I wanted to be a theater director. Most theater directors were wealthy to begin with and had a trust fund. And a large proportion of them were also gay. And I felt somehow that I didn't fit. I went to see Day for Night, La Nuit Americaine, the Truffaut film. I learned Day for Night shot for shot from memory so that I could simply write it down. You know, sit down at a table and say, okay, this is the first shot, the next shot, it cuts to this, it cuts to that, it goes to this, it goes, and just every shot, so that you learn to think in the vocabulary of the images. And somewhere after that, I found an experimental college in that the state of New York had that had a good film program. And I went there and just made up my own program.
I think John is one of the few directors who is able to make the camera dance on a show. I think he treats the camera as an actor almost, as an individual, and the camera moves take on a personality of their own, which makes the movie and which makes the performance of the other actors more coherent, more cohesive, and more exciting. So I think he has the most difficult camera moves, by the way, that you can ever imagine. We have, rehearsing them are quite extensive and are quite difficult often. But it's these, I think, camera angles and camera moves that give his work a unique style.
I had just started writing to continue working as a director. And it was sort of, the notion was, I'm going to write until I have something that someone wants to make badly enough that they'll even let me direct it. So I just attached myself to each script I did. And they didn't have to use me as a director, but they had to pay me to direct it. And it usually in the... it was enough money that it would get their attention, and actually they'd consider having me direct it.
McTiernan eventually received a fellowship from the American Film Institute. With a grant from AFI, he made a short film, Watcher, starring Edward Franz and Diana Douglas. From there, he honed his skills and made his living directing commercials and eventually some television films while writing his first screenplay. That script, Nomads, became his feature directorial debut in 1986 and starred Pierce Brosnan and Leslie Ann Down.
You know, in retrospect, I can now look back at it and say, obviously the man had talent. I've worked with a lot of directors who are not first-time directors, who simply did not have the eye or the vision that John had. I mean, he knew what he wanted. At times, we would go to him and we would say, John, we truly don't understand this scene. We don't know what is going on. I mean, it was in John's head. I mean, that's where a lot of it stayed. He didn't come forward a lot of the time. There were some very satisfactory explanations, but he got it on film, and so we just did what we were told most of the time, and he got it on film. And that's very rare. That's rare for directors, first-time directors especially, to have that vision.
I mean, I'd done a fair amount of film work by the time I got to that moment, so it wasn't like the first time I walked onto a movie set or I didn't feel foreign or like this was a completely different experience. It essentially was a student movie that was a little bit longer and hopefully was going to be distributed.
What happened to you? What happened?
Ne vous effrayez pas.
Talk.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Il ne s'est pas. Il ne s'est pas. Il ne s'est pas. See here.
Was sort of killing off Remington Steele. And actually he described it as, you imagine that you have a string coming from the top of your head, so everything happens like this. And basically our work was get rid of the string and figure out how to sit there, to add gravity to him. And I put him on a diet where he had to drink four or five beers a day and stuff, just to thicken him up and make him. And he loved all of that stuff. He loved changing himself. And so it was a shame that when they first cast him in a Bond thing, maybe about 4 years ago or so, and then I don't know if it was NBC, one of the television networks stepped in and wouldn't let him do it. It was a shame because he's perfect for it. And now he is doing it, finally.
When we did Nomads, I was married to film director William Friedkin. And Bill is a very intense human being and a great director. When I met John and then worked with John, he had those same qualities. He was extremely intense. And he was extremely knowing and in control of what he wanted. He wasn't a malleable human being. And I think that actors have to be malleable. Directors are there. They are the captain of the ship. They have to know what they're doing. And that is kind of rare to see that. In any director, it's rare, especially today. You know, the producers are the money guys. You do what they want you to do. You rap when they want you to rap, etc., etc. And John truly wasn't like that at all. He was his own boss, and he danced to his own song.
I'm never particularly pleased with my own work, certainly immediately after. Or maybe there's a period where it gets far enough in the past that you can go back and look at it, where you've forgotten all of the... When you first finish a piece, the only thing that's in your mind is where you failed. When you first see it, all you see is a litany of your failures, of the places where it doesn't measure up to what was on the back of your eyelids. So it's a very, it's a very painful experience. I don't know, I think Kubrick once said if he's getting 50% of what he went to get, he's doing very well, and he's happy with himself. But when you first start, if you get 10% of what you had in mind, you're doing well. And gradually, as you get better, it doesn't sting as badly, but it still stings, so you can't... I don't look at my own motives afterwards. I mean, once it's finished, it's done, and I don't want to see it for a while.
McTiernan's first big-budgeted studio film was the 1987 production of Predator, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers, and produced by Joel Silver. Predator clearly established McTiernan's reputation as a major director of action-adventure films.
The most difficult thing about it was that I was coming into an organization and it was already extant. And had its own notions and, to some extent, its own corruption. And the designer worked for Silver. And he insisted that we go to Puerto Vallarta in Mexico. What he didn't bother to find out was that the west coast of Mexico is deciduous. The leaves on the trees, which form the appearance of jungle just next to the resort hotels on the beach, the leaves fall off the trees every year, a certain time of the year. Happened to be when we were shooting. So it all turned orange on us. So the hardest thing in the thing was trying to pretend that there was jungle in the... around Puerto Vallarta. Fortunately, the monster came in and it was bad, and we shut down to get a better monster. And by then, I had a chance to cut the first portion of the film, and the studio saw it, and so I had a little bit of credibility. And when we went back to shoot the movie, we went to Palenque. And that's where anything that looks like actual jungle came from that's in that movie, as we shot it down there. The politics of, you know, how you... It's a very odd thing that, I mean, you so often wind up wearing other people's mistakes, but they were mistakes that you saw going in, but you couldn't stop it. And so how you maneuver toward... How you maneuver out of other people's mistakes is often one of the hardest things to do.
There aren't too many movies, I think, that make the impact that that movie made with a science fiction backdrop is probably fairly adequate and accurate in terms of description. But John he probably, as far as the guys I've worked with anyway, probably moves a camera as well as anyone I've ever worked with or anyone I've ever known who directs. He just has a sense of lenses and knows how to crank the energy from slight moves to grand moves with camera and create tension and feature actors as well as anyone I've seen. He has a way with composition that is just tremendous.
That we had to take this creature and put him in the jungle. And to make the creature, we had to, in effect, make a hole in the jungle. We had to get a photograph of a jungle with an area that's in the shape of the creature that isn't there, that we could just separate out. It's, in effect, a blue screen, except we use red. Jean-Claude Van Damme had just come to Hollywood, and he was represented by William Morris. They came to me and said, can't he play the monster or something? They sent him off to the special effects guys who fitted him out with a red suit. Jean-Claude came out. He was so angry. He couldn't. This string of Belgian obscenity came out of him. He couldn't get a word out of him that wasn't F or S blank, blank, blank. I think that lasted maybe about a day before we all realized that this wasn't really Jean-Claude's big break in the movies. This probably shouldn't be his first film. Because he had been told that he was, well, that it was a significant part. That was probably what his agent told him, and he discovered that he was basically a technical prop and something. We also at one point tried to dress up a monkey in a red suit so I could get pictures of a creature jumping through the trees. The monkey wouldn't keep a suit on, was the problem. Arnold obviously competes in everything, and Carl was an experienced actor and a well-trained one. And Arnold was really just learning. And so he used to come down and watch. He used to watch Carl work. The thing that was most significant in the long run was Arnold watching Carl and trying to learn about acting. Because he did learn. And he went at it with the same attitude that he might have gone at a bodybuilding competition or some sports thing. Or just, okay, let's go for it. He's got a great attitude that way.
You son of a bitch. What's the matter? The CIA got you pushing too many pencils? Huh? Had enough?
Make it easy on yourself, Dutch.
Okay.
But didn't know when to quit, huh?
Damn good to see you, Dutch.
What is this fucking Thai business?
Oh, come on, forget about my Thai, man.
I heard about that little job you pulled up in Berlin.
Very nice, Dutch.
Good old days.
Yeah, like the good old days. Then how come you passed on Libya, huh?
Oh, that wasn't my style.
You got no style, Dutch, you know that. Come on.
Why'd you pass? We a rescue team, not assassins.
I think I looked at Predator the other day, and it didn't sting. I could say, oh, that's nice. There's some interesting things there. Oh, not bad. Because all of the places that I had other things in mind were right in my head.
He's a guy that you want to emulate. He just has a tremendous ability, and he's a tremendously bright guy, which doesn't necessarily always equate, but you put the two together and I think you got one hell of a director there.
McTiernan's 1988 production of Die Hard starred Bruce Willis in the role that made Willis a major star. The film also featured actors Alan Rickman, Bonnie Bedelia, and William Atherton. Die Hard received first-rate reviews around the world and was one of the most successful box office releases of 1988.
Well, you knew it was going to be an atomic movie, you know what I mean? You knew it was going to be this nuclear movie, because, you know, you had Bruce doing this. This is his first big movie star movie, you know? And you had Joel Silver, who was kind of his own creative engine. And, yeah, you knew it was going to be that way, but you never really know it's going to be. You know it's going to be, and then when it is, it's always a surprise. You know it's going to be, and everybody goes to lunch, and everybody, you know, flatters everybody else, and then when it really works, you're still surprised. But you knew it was going to be large one way or the other.
Holy shit.
Tell me you got that.
I got it.
Hit your heart on channel 5.
I must say I was completely shocked when I walked on the set, because I'd made some fairly large budgeted films, but nothing quite of this magnitude. And it was like walking into Grand Central Station at rush hour. I've been making movies for 30 years, and it was quite overwhelming. The first time I met John McTiernan, the first time I remember meeting him, I was in a wardrobe fitting for Die Hard, and he buzzed by to say hello and welcome me, obviously making a film of, you know, the magnitude of Die Hard. One is it's just a mountainous job, so he was very busy, and he just stopped by to say hello, and he said, part of the reason that I cast you in this movie is because I'll have one less thing to worry about. And then he went on to say, Ilya Kazan, I am not. So if you have any questions or you want to talk about character or anything of that sort, don't come to me. Which at the time I thought was amazingly honest. And then, of course, when I got on the set, I found that that was not the case at all. He didn't speak very much. He was a very quiet director. But when he said something, it was very clear and to the point. And I was very appreciative of his presence.
I have a request.
What idiot put you in charge?
You did. When you murdered my boss. Now everybody's looking to me. Personally, I pass on the job. I don't enjoy being this close to you.
Go on.
We have a pregnant woman out there. Relax, she's not due for a couple of weeks, but sitting on that rock isn't doing her back any good. So I would like permission to move her to one of the offices where there's a sofa.
No, but I'll have a sofa brought out to you. Good enough?
Good enough. And unless you like it messy, I'd start bringing us in groups to the bathroom.
Yes, you're right. It will be done. Was there something else?
No, thank you.
I basically structured it as a comedy, and it was actually, it's Midsummer Night's Dream, which is something happens on a festival night that turns the world upside down. And all the princes become asses, and all the asses become princes. And in the morning, the true lovers are reunited, and everyone goes on with the world. But the world is better than it was the night before.
I guess the major change we made was turning it into a robbery. And that was when I said, yes, I do it, when they said, okay, you can do that. Just because, I never found terrorism entertaining. But a good robbery is fun. Whether the bad guys or the good guys, people love to watch a good caper. Changed a great deal once we started working with Bruce, and it fit in perfectly for me because what I did was, then I had a working class hero. I mean, I just tried to use what Bruce was about, to use that. And the essence of Bruce is sort of that cartoon about there's a mouse and the shadow of an eagle is coming down on him and he's going like this at the eagle. And that sort of smartass, that sort of irreverence in the face of doom.
I thought I told all of you I want radio silence until further...
I'm very sorry, Hans. I didn't get that message.
Maybe you should have put it on the bulletin board.
I waxed Tony and Marco and his friend here. I figured you and Carl and Franco might be a little lonely, so I wanted to give you a call.
How does he know so much about this?
This is very kind of you. As you draw out a mysterious party crasher, you're most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, Hans, wrong guess.
Would you like to go for double jeopardy where the scores can really change?
These are very bad for you.
Who are you, then?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. The pain in the ass. Whoa.
A lot of it evolved as it went along. I think when we started shooting, we only had 35 pages of a finished script. It became actually, in a way, it was a very creative environment because everyone knew we were making up a movie as we went along, so it was everybody spent more time thinking, in a way, and ideas would come from everywhere. I would encourage people to make up their own dialogue and change things as they wanted and come up with character things.
McTiernan was offered the sequel to Die Hard, Die Hard 2, which also starred Bruce Willis, but turned the project down because he believed he would be repeating himself.
Well, the basic intention, they wanted to go out and make the same movie over again, which I thought was silly. It's a hack intention. Which goes back to that money question about, if you're just taking a job for a job, then... And often people who make sequels are just, making the movie for the money. And the thinking that goes in it is kind of second rate.
I think John really wants to entertain people. He wants to make sure that his movies are enjoyed by the widest of audiences. I think he loves to do action adventure kind of things. John, since he's personally become a very close friend, also loves the outdoor, loves gadgets, loves to tinker with those things, and I think he would like to fascinate audiences with the same kind of fun that he can have. And I think basically entertaining people or just having pure fun, I think, would be, his goal.
I tend to gravitate toward movies I'd like to see. The movies I'd like to see are often by and large, sort of boys' adventure movies. Big boys, little boys are still boys' adventure movies. So if that makes me an action director, they can label me that way. I don't care.
In 1990, McTiernan brought to the screen Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October, starring Sean Connery and Alec Baldwin, with a supporting cast that included Sam Neill, Scott Glenn, James Earl Jones, and Tim Curry. The film was an international success.
Whatever the novel gave us, and the film script gave us, and the cast will give you in this motion picture, you have a director who has gained an expertise in action-adventure film, considering Die Hard and Predator, movies like that, which I watch as if I was a 12-year-old kid, you know, totally captured by it and captivated by it. And you will get that kind of expertise exercise on this film, you know, from John.
I tried to buy the book. And I missed the book by about a week. I sold it to somebody else. And the problem was that the people who'd worked on it before thought it was some sort of international thriller, or thought it was about bombs, or thought it was about tough action stuff. And what it was really about is it's Treasure Island. You know, it's about a boy, even though he's 35 years old, he's a boy in the environment he functions in the bureaucratic political world he's in. He's the kid at the end of the table. He's a boy. And he comes to possess a piece of information, a map or an insight, that leads to him going to sea. And he's swept off with a bunch of bizarre characters. And something in his innate nature allows him or helps him to solve whatever the crisis is. You know, and he comes back from sea forever changed. The thing that's ironic is that I tried to get Harrison Ford to play the part. I pursued him something awful after Alec did it. Then he was apparently interested. There was a great deal of scheming that went on to push Alec out of that part. It's not a pleasant subject, and I will probably offend a lot of people if you get me into it too far.
What's important enough to get you on a plane in the middle of the night?
British intelligence obtained these pictures 2 days ago. She's the Red October, the latest Typhoon class.
Big son of a bitch.
12 meters longer than the standard Typhoon, 3 meters wider. Captain's name is Ramius.
One of yours?
Yeah, I did the bio on him last year. He's taken out the lead boat in each new subclass for the last 10 years. Fairly good political connections. Trained most of their attack boat skippers. The Russians call him Vilnius Nastavnik, the Vilnius schoolmaster.
What are these doors?
Those doors, sir, are the problem. I don't know what they are. Neither do the British. Perhaps our friends in Murmansk have come up with something new.
The biggest thing, other than the material and the role, was to work with John. I really like John's work a lot. And I think that for this genre, for this kind of movie, there's nobody who can touch John in the whole business. You know, he's the foremost director of action-adventure films, I think, today.
Sean's character is basically Long John Silver in a lot of ways. The Russian captain is Long John Silver. It's a person who is potentially very dangerous and that you don't trust, who you come to love in the end. But on the first day Sean was going to come in, he called the AD, the assistant director, in, or to the side of the stage, and he dressed him down something royal. He just gave him One hell of a shellacking. And it was in a place where everyone else could hear. I didn't know what was going on. I thought, you know, Sean's really in a bad way and he's in a bad mood and boy, are we going to have trouble. But as soon as he walked onto the set, this little Russian kid, who was doing okay, but this little Russian kid involuntarily stiffened like this, was watching him and turned right to his business and was scared stiff. And I watched it go down the line. Every actor and non-actor on the set stiffened involuntarily when Sean got anywhere near them and when Sean stepped onto the bridge, in effect. And that was when I caught on that he did it deliberately. It was all staged. What he was doing was setting up all of the other actors in the scene to behave toward him as if he really were the captain. So it was a performance that he didn't have to act like the captain. They treated him like the captain, and that made him the captain. So he could go there and do almost nothing. All he had to do was simply stand or move or do whatever he wanted. He could be completely relaxed. But everything around him said, this is the captain. This is a very intimidating, awesome character. Be careful. It was brilliant the way he did it. And so simply done.
Captain, he has opened his outer doors and is preparing to fire.
Flood tubes 3 and 4 and plot a solution.
Aye, Captain. Flood tubes 3 and 4, plot solution.
Flood 3
and 4, aye. Shall I open the torpedo tube doors, sir? Captain, shall I open outer doors?
No. Lock the firing solution into the computer. Do not open the doors.
Aye, Captain.
You don't have to help Sean develop his role. Sean's too good a professional. And you just better run fast enough to keep up with him is the hard part. Because he doesn't suffer fools well. And if you're not paying attention and keeping up with him, he'll eat you alive. We built the submarines on gimbals so that they would roll and tilt. Because you can't really... I looked at all the 1940s submarine movies where you have all these guys pretending to lean sideways, and it looks phony. There are just too many cues, visual cues, in the bodies of the actors that tell you this is phony. So we actually built it for real. And that was occasionally difficult. One of the best things they did is they took Scott Glenn, took him out on another boat where he was the only movie person. And Scott was going to have to play a captain in the film. And the captain of the boat that he went out on decided that the best way to teach Scott, this kid was brilliant, this boat captain, what he did is he issued orders, instructions to everyone in his crew that for the next 5 days, everyone is to behave towards Scott Glenn as if he were the captain of this ship. That submarine captain taught him how to do the role. I didn't have anything to do with it. All I did is try to... I set up the thing that he'd go to sea, but the submarine captain is the one who taught him. And when he came back from the submarine, it was completely different. His manner was completely different. It was basically about being a teacher. It was about kind of taking care of your men, as about reading what's going on in the men around you.
Comm sonar, signal to noise ratios dropping. Possible aspect change in target.
Recur possible target sig based on ferry rate.
Comm sonar, crazy Ivan.
Captain, he's turning.
Which way is he turning, Jones?
To the starboard, sir.
Give the man a chance.
All back full.
Say again?
I said all back full.
Back full, aye, sir. This is back full.
Captain,
Captain, we're cavitating. He can hear us.
29. All stop.
Stop, Ike.
All right, Ryan. We just unzipped our fly. Mr. Thompson, open the outer doors. Firing point procedures. Now, if that bastard so much as twitches, I'm going to blow him right to Mars.
McTiernan teamed up with Sean Connery once again for the 1992 production of Medicine Man, co-starring Lorraine Bracco. Set in the remote Amazon rainforest, the production presented many technical challenges for McTiernan and producer Andrew Vanya.
Well, Medicine Man was difficult because of its jungle location. Having to spend 14 weeks in the middle of Mexico in a jungle in a city that basically has no phones and one supermarket and really not much to do other than make the movie makes it a tough location. On the other hand, it is also positive because you have nothing else to sort of keep you busy or sidetrack you, so you're focusing on getting the movie as fast as possible.
That's what I mean when I say I can't reproduce it.
Wait a minute. I don't understand.
What don't you understand? I found a cure for the fucking plague of the 20th century, and now I've lost it. Haven't you ever lost anything, Dr. Bronx? Your pass, your car keys? Well, it's rather like that. Now you have it, now you don't.
Your notes are gone?
I have my notes. I followed my notes.
Your notes must be wrong.
They're not.
Then explain it.
I can't.
Okay. The first thing I do when I get to L.A. is I get Dr. Krause and his people can set up a real lab down here.
There's nothing wrong with this lab. We've got everything we need.
Look, this is Major League. You need help.
I think on Medicine Man, John was very interesting. He wanted to create a stage, an outdoor stage, if you will, in the middle of the jungle, so that we had the particular set, once we picked a location, wired for everything. So if we wanted to rain, all we had to do is turn a handle. If we wanted to sprinkle, all we had to do is turn a handle. If we wanted to fog, all we had to do is turn a handle. So we had everything pre-wired and pre-hooked so we could walk on and use this very difficult location. Otherwise, it's a very easy indoor set. So he had pre-thought it out about what kind of things he would need and how he would need them, so we would always be prepared to shoot at the moment's notice.
We developed a system of cables and moving entries, and then we had to teach the actors how to do it. They had a couple of weeks invested in that, in learning how to move safely in the trees, and we had to teach most of the crew. So we did. We wound up spending, I don't know, 6 or 8 days where we really just lived in the trees. That was at times kind of difficult.
All right. Come on.
Oh, God.
Think of Neil Armstrong.
Environmental movie, we did extraordinarily well. I think it was about $60 million domestic box office and 170 or so international, total rather, which for an environmental movie, in quotes, is very good. I mean, it's unfortunate we discovered afterwards we had gotten a lot of flack from someone calling environmental groups around the world saying we had done, we were doing all this damage to trees and things. So there were continual stories in the press about that. And we eventually discovered there was somebody back in Hollywood, a particular person in Hollywood who was poisoning it. It's astonishing how carcinogenic some people are.
In 1993, McTiernan directed Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Last Action Hero, an action spoof of movies within a movie. The film went on to gross over $175 million, but did not prove to be a happy experience for McTiernan.
Who the hell are you?
Don't shoot me. I'm Danny Madigan. I'm a kid.
How did you get here?
I'm not quite sure where here is, sir, but I don't think you want to know.
Okay, close your eyes, stay flat, and don't move. It's easy to practice a lot and never ever do it in heavy traffic.
John tends to push it right to the limit and over the limit with movement of lenses, and it creates some incredibly difficult but great shots. Once again, it was all planned very carefully by John, and he'd planned it so that we could include Arnold in as much stuff as possible, which is what he's good at, you know, involving the principal players in the action, keeping them involved. So you're looking at the movie knowing that it's Arnold there and not obviously stunt people.
Studio environment was not a particularly good one in that, and it ultimately was destructive. Okay, I shouldn't leave an illusion like that, a tantalizing tale hanging out there. No, it was just, see, we were making a movie that was about a fairy godfather. It's a very childish PG-13 kids movie. And somewhere in the middle of it, the studio said, "No, wait a minute, we're making an action movie." And, you know, I tried to, like, call a halt and hold a meeting and say, "Gentlemen, will you sort this out? I'll make one or I'll make the other, but how are you trying to do both at the same time?" You know, and they began rewriting the script in the middle of it. After I was already shooting, they're rewriting behind me. It was like, rough. You know, you come home each day and wonder what it is the studio has in mind for you to shoot next week, or how are they planning to change this movie? How are they planning to change the end of the movie where you've already started the front end of it? This was a case where some of the studio people involved were making a deal and not a movie. And they had sold it to themselves and to each other by making it as vague as possible about what they were doing. You know, it was all things to every person. And then when it fell to some people to make it specific, or when it began to become specific, then you have people charging in different directions saying, "No, we're doing this, and no, we're doing that, and you can't do that while you're shooting."
Hear this?
Help me! Get me out of here!
My God! His men's not dead!
This man needs a doctor!
I'm a doctor.
You a doctor?
Yes.
Check his chin.
Doctor has fainted. Can somebody help this man here? I think the squabs. I mean, the patient. Look, elephant.
Otis, don't shoot. You would drop Leo.
He's very quiet, but if something isn't right, he knows it. He's always thinking. And you could never mistake his quietness for someone who isn't actively thinking and observing. He is absolutely there at all times. So in his quietness, or I'm sure in his stillness, he's actually coming up with shots, how he sees something. And so he's thinking, he's working in that quietness.
And action.
Yo, hey, Mark, wait up. Hey.
Die Hard with a Vengeance is McTiernan's 1995 follow-up to his original Die Hard film. It proved to be an enormous success with audiences worldwide, and once again starred Bruce Willis and a supporting cast that included Samuel L. Jackson, Colleen Camp, and Jeremy Irons. McTiernan also teamed up again with producer Andrew Vanya.
When I approached John to do Die Hard 3, he said, well, I wouldn't be interested in doing it unless we could come up with certainly something unique and something different. Everybody and their grandson has made Die Hard on a train, Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on an elevator, Die Hard everywhere. So I think the format has been widely copied, and our job really was to come up with the third picture in a row that was substantially different. Yes, of course, to top himself, and yes, of course, to...